So it is 3:28:96, and I'm with Lanny Haldy, Executive Director of the Amana Heritage Society. It's a correct title. Okay.
Very good.
You might just want to start by stating what your relationship is with Amana, when you were born, if you were born here.
Okay. When I say I was born here in Amana, that's qualified in a hospital in Cedar Rapids, of course. But my family came from Amana, as did a lot of family before that. I'm not really into genealogy, but I know that the first Haldy person joined the church back in Germany in like 1740. So they've been associated with the community for a long time. And I grew up as part of it.
And what year would have you been born?
Oh, I thought I could sneak by that.
50,
I was born in 52.
52.
Yeah.
Okay. So as a child growing up, were you aware of Amana's heritage? Were you aware of the history behind the community?
Yeah, I was. Primarily through my grandmother, who lived in the same house as us, and the people she hung around with, she was very much into the history, and the community always kept a chronicle and a written account of its past, and she read that all the time. She practically had it memorized. And she would tell me some of the stories in it and that kind of thing. But you know what's strange about that is that I never really thought of it as anything special. You know, it was just those are the stories my grandmother told me and things like that. And it really wasn't until I was away in college and was a history major and realized that the community I lived in had a very interesting history right then and there. I didn't have to go far afield to find a very interesting past. And I think part of that was the fact that I say I go to my grandmother. I don't go directly to my parents because my parents were really of that generation that was in effect still trying to merge into American society after the communal era, and like my grandmother spoke German to me, my parents spoke English to me. My grandmother would tell me about the history and the church and that kind of thing, but my parents, you know, it was important to them, I now know, but they certainly weren't trying to instill that heritage into me as much as my grandparents were. So that even in the Sunday school, you know, in the Amana Church Sunday school, I grew up thinking essentially the Amana Church was a Lutheran, or at least close to, you know, I knew it wasn't Lutheran, but, you know, it was always said, well, the Amana Church is an offshoot of the Lutheran Church. Well, you could say the Lutheran Church is an offshoot of Catholicism, and of course it doesn't really get to the heart of the matter. So that really not until I learned more about generally the religious heritage of the Reformation and post-Reformation in Europe and was able to put the Amana Church history into that kind of perspective was did I become aware of what it really was about.
So would you say that re-emphasizing the communal past was a trait of your generation, whereas your parents' generation was moving away from history in a sense. Did the generation after move?
Yeah, I mean that's a very bald generalization, but I think it's basically true. I mean, and you know, I want to emphasize that it wasn't just the communal heritage. You know, it's just heritage very generally where our generation was looking more, you know, and even then, it wasn't when we were real young. It's, you know, it's really something that probably we didn't start doing until in our early 20s or something. That anyway, at my age, there were younger people at that time, but again, you know, it was those people, you know, it was happening around the very late 60s or early 70s. And obviously there were some younger people involved in there, but of course at that time I was, you know, 18, mm-hmm. 20, you know, again, off in college. But I think you're right in getting to that point that it was that generation, you know, re-emphasizing our past and our heritage as, and not ashamed of it. You know, I think my parents' generation, I think in a way, were ashamed is too strong a word, but certainly not proud of their heritage because of World War II, the anti-German animosity during World War II, the fact that communal manna was always considered kind of a quaint and backwards place. So that they were really kind of renouncing that past and saying, hey, we're as American as anybody else, we're as modern as anybody else. You know, they were trying to make a statement that they weren't different. You know, they were trying to show everyone that they were Americans like everybody else. And I think, you know, I think a society had matured enough by the late 60s so that people again could say, hey, I'm proud that I have an accent, or I'm proud that I know German, or that I have a religious heritage like this, or that I belong to the Amana Church. There was certainly no reason for us, for our generation, to be ashamed of it.
When you were away at university, did you ever get any reactions from your fellow students when you mentioned that you were from Amana? Were there misconceptions? Did people know what that meant?
I would say generally people knew that it meant something, but they weren't exactly sure what, you know, and certainly it was not a negative reaction. A lot of friends I made in school, you know, would come and visit here. Actually, a lot of my friends in college, you know, maybe lived here for a summer then or something like that, you know, because apartments were cheaper there and that kind of thing. But the only negative thing I can ever recall is that they would make fun of, and in a very, you know, not in a bitter way or anything, but they would make fun of how people from Amana spoke. Apparently we've got some kind of inflection in our voice or something going up at the end or something. And then, you know, so that's really the only thing that I ever heard that even would make me think I was different in any way or anything like that.
Was there any kind, as far as you know, and I realize that you were away during some of the period in question, 65 to 75, but was there a type of counterculture in Amana similar to the counterculture that was pervading the rest of the United States amongst the younger generation?
Yeah, I think similar is the key word there. I don't think it was as intense as some places. I mean, I don't know how intense that counterculture could be in a small rural community anyway. I mean, certainly there were individuals into it and that kind of thing, but and you know, with popular media and all that, it was virtually impossible to not kind of tune into that, if I could use that. I'm afraid. But I don't, you know, and I think in that sense it was a counterculture which was an American counterculture rather than an Amana counterculture too. You know, we adopted the same symbols and slogans and as everybody else. I mean, the one thing that was maybe a little bit different was the formation of a group. The abbreviation was UHUH, which was, again, I was away at school at that time and really wasn't very involved in that, but that was really you could call it a countercultural group, which had a specific purpose of trying to preserve the heritage of our community. And And I think the Amana Heritage Society, the organization I work for, kind of came out of that same thing. I mean, I think preservation, surprisingly enough, was kind of a revolutionary idea. That we've got, you know, we've got a heritage, we've got a community here. We have a wonderful natural heritage and landscape and architectural heritage, a cultural heritage, a religious heritage. So let's not muck it up. Let's do something to try to preserve it, and let's certainly not be ashamed of it. So I think, you know, those two groups that came out here were a little bit more, you know, obviously aimed towards Amana, and I think it came out of that general countercultural movement in the United States. But I hesitate to say it was a hippie movement or anything like that. It was that kind of, you know, that social, that notion that everybody is important, you know, non-elitist, local history is important. Our little neck of the woods is as important as anybody else, and when we're obligated to try to do something to make it a better place, you know, you could make the world a better place by starting right here. I mean, certainly those kind of ideas were helping to motivate that. But I can't say it was, you know, I can't say it was really that communal tradition, you know, directly that was influencing that. Because, we mentioned in some of our other conversations, I think a lot of people, you know, would say it's the religious tradition that's probably more important than the communal tradition. But certainly that communal tradition helped focus that whole notion of community. You know, the church, the official name of the church was the Community of True Inspiration long before it became a communal society. So there was always in the religious tradition that sense of community, the sense that a church is a community. So, it really was coming out of that more than, you know, common ownership of property and all people are equal and that kind of thing.
Am I correct that the Amana Heritage Society, it wasn't a group started by younger people? It was a group started by people the generation previous to you. Is that how it came about?
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. And again, of course, it was people. You know, it was people a little younger than my parents. You know, it was, you know, I can't say it was a full generation up there, but it was people in there at the time they started it. They were probably in their 30s, mm-hmm. mid-30s. And again, I have to bring in tourism there because really what made those people stop and think were not any real high-flying ideals, but they were seeing thousands and thousands of tourists coming to visit this place. And, you know, I think, you know, they had to stop and think, why? You know, what is the attraction that would bring all these people here? And that really started to make them, I'm sure in reading the notes and stuff, that started to make them think that, by golly, we do have something important here. You know, we have to preserve it for our children. You know, and plus we have to explain it so that these people who are coming know what it's all about. So that, you know, I think that combination of the countercultural emphasis on local history and the tourist curiosity about the place really helped, you know, get the Heritage Society started.
Did the war in Vietnam have any effect on Amana, since you would have been of age for that?
Yeah, it did have an effect, but certainly not as great as it did in some other communities. I mean, there are people who had to go fight the war. There are some people who died, but very few. you know, that lottery, you know, the draft lottery came in just at, you know, towards the end of the war, and luckily me and all my friends got high numbers, mm-hmm. you know. It was those people a little older than me who really, you know, did go to war and fight and die sometimes. But, like I say, it was very few, and, you know, so it really didn't hit home that hard. You know, there was anti-war sentiment among, you know, among our generation. We put some leaflets out and stuff sometime. And I remember I was the editor of our high school yearbook, and one of the silly things I did, now that I think about it, you know, the final message, you know, the kind of final note from the editor on the back page, I had the word spaced so that it made a big peace sign, you know, on the mm-hmm. page. but like I say, really that, the you know, we came in kind of on the tail end of the war. You know, when I was a senior, well, it wasn't the way tail end, when I was a senior, it was Cambodia happened, the invasion of Cambodia. And, but really those times when people were just being sent over there just by the thousands had happened a little bit before me. And again, it was an issue, but it was a distant enough issue that I don't think there were very, the passions were not real high one way or another.
The late 60s and early 70s, especially for the younger generation, were a time where a lot of religious values were questioned, especially traditional, perhaps parental religious values. What's your take on that in terms of Amana and the people that were your age in the Amana Church?
That's a good question. I think in a way it might have almost been, well, in a way it was opposite that. I mean, certainly there was a questioning of traditional values, but I wouldn't say that that went over onto traditional religious values. In a way, I think, you know, a lot of the kids were reasserting, quote, religious values, even if they weren't very, you know, if it wasn't specifically this doctrine or that practice or that kind of thing. Yeah, like, many of the people that I grew up with, in fact, are now very active in the church, and became so, you know, at that time. You know, most of us were away at school and really weren't, you know, mm-hmm. that intimately involved in what was going on here, except during the summers. Mm-hmm. But I don't see the rebellion as a rebellion against the Amana Church. You know, the rebellion was against the materialism and that mainstreaming that the generation had done. I think really what people wanted was for, what I always saw as a weakness was the Amana Church did not play a strong social role. It was not play a role of a social conscience. You know, it was too wishy-washy on moral issues. You know, it was too comfortable. You know, so I think in a way it wasn't a rebellion against traditional values. It was saying, if you're going to be religious, then be religious.
Kathy had mentioned to me that during this period, she was a little younger, but she'd sent off and received some information on the farm and said that she had she'd expressed a desire to her parents to go and travel to Tennessee and so forth. Did you have any inclinations towards other communities?
No, I can't say I did. I mean, I was aware of them. I had some of Stephen and the Farm Band's albums. As a matter of fact. You know, so I was aware of that kind of thing. But I guess I was always, I've always been very content and really have had no urge to, I mean, I like to go visit and things like that, but, you know, I never really felt I wanted to go off and join a community or anything like that. But, you know, reading about that kind of stuff and being aware of it, I think helped create a sense of that it is something important in people's lives and that you should cultivate it wherever you can. I guess I always felt a part of a community already. I mean, that's the bottom line, I think.
One thing I'm curious about, and this, I guess this could only be gauged in terms of tourism, but there, you know, still talking about 65 to 75, there was a, communes came to the surface again in the United States, so to speak. Did more people travel, come to visit Amana, because it, you know, was a historical community?
No, I think people came to Amana because it was, and people still come to Amana, I think, because it shows, it's a very obvious example of the simple fact that in the past, as well as in the present, I mean, it can be extended to the present, people have lived in ways different from what we consider mainstream American culture. I think it presents an alternative that people find very attractive. And, you know, I think the idea of community and of living together and of, you know, working for the common good, I think that idea is very strong in American society. And that when people find such, a 26,000-acre example of that, I think it's very compelling. I don't know if people know that, but I'm convinced that that's what the attraction is to the tourist, to Amana. Is that it presents something that it presents an alternative to individualism. You know, even if that isn't exactly all true, but you know that image that what would I call it? That myth, as it were, of an American communal success, I think, is very compelling.
What do you think that the tourist trade does for community in Amana? Do you think it helps to maintain community, or it detracts from it?
I think in a way, it detracts from community in that a lot of people's energy, rather than going into, like a perfect example, I think, is rather than the town getting together and having their own 4th of July picnic, they'll waste all their energy on putting on an Oktoberfest. Mm-hmm. You know, just in terms of festivals, instead of festivals oriented towards celebrating ourselves, you know, let's do a festival for the tourist. You know, so I think in a way that detracts from community. On the other hand, I think the fact that we think of ourselves as a community is partly because of the tourist interest in us. I'm convinced that if there had been no tourism to Amana in the 60s, our heritage would have been lost a long time ago. That really, I mean, when you see that the architectural changes, the cultural changes that were happening in the 50s and in the early 60s, you know, I think the fact that, you know, people, as I mentioned before, realize that, hey, there's something here that is attracting these people. What is it? We better hang on to it. I think that helped define the community. It helped define community values. So I think tourism is one way that makes us focus on ourselves as a community. You know, and we have to think about How do we present ourselves to these people? Who are we? You know, how do we market ourselves? You know, tourism forces us to think about who we are, which in other communities, people might not ever, in other small towns, people might never stop and think about who they are or what they want to be or how they want to present themselves to the outside. So that, you know, tourism is very, you have to be careful. I certainly would not unqualifiedly stand up and say, yay, I'm for tourism. But it's helped us define ourselves, and that's not even mentioning the economic impact. I mean, the bottom line is, Amana is a pretty easy place to live financially. It's, you know, prices are low. You can get, you know, get products and stuff. I mean, it's an easy place, and that's because of tourism. I mean, without tourism, this would be a whole different place. There's no doubt about it. I'm not saying it, you know, tourism has detracted in some ways. Some of the development and that kind of stuff, I think, has been ill-advised. Mm-hmm. But it's still very important. People in Amana are very, very, I think they're very psychologically, fundamentally ambivalent about tourism. They, you know, we wish we wouldn't need it, but we realize deep inside how important it is. So it's strange.
This was a question that was deferred to you earlier in the day, but do you see a danger as far as Amana and community are concerned? With land use and the need to please tourists, to make things, conveniences for tourists?
Well, I think I mentioned this to you before, but my philosophy is if we make Amana a nice place to live, it will be a nice place to visit. So that I go about what I do, and basically that's my fundamental philosophy on land use, on historic preservation, on all those community issues. Is the primary thing is it going to be a tourist attraction, but will it make Amana a nice place to live? And will it make it a better place for residents? And I'm convinced that if the answer to that question is yes, then the tourism will happen. The visitation will happen. I do not like things to happen just with tourism as the only justification. You know, I cannot see that. And I don't think it does happen very often. What we do here at the museum is oriented towards the tourist, our tourist audience. But most of it is oriented towards preserving this, our heritage, for ourselves, you know. And I think the fact that this organization exists, even though it might draw tourists, still the Amana Heritage Society helps make Amana a good place, you know, to live here. So that's how I look at that. I think most people, you know, maybe probably agree with me that you can't ignore tourism, but you can't make it the driving force. You can't make it as the ultimate standard by which to judge things. There are very few people who think that. So I guess I'm fairly optimistic that this tourism urge can be curtailed. Really, you know, that, you know, I think people, you know, people think already that Amana is too overly commercial and overly developed. And it might be, but boy, compared to a lot of places, it ain't. You know, so I think just the fact that people are already reacting against overdevelopment and over tourism, too much tourism, I think that's a healthy sign. It shows that we are stopping to think about what we're doing.
We talked about the church a little already, but I guess a question I have is, how historically has the church maintained a sense of community in Amana, especially when not every community member is a church member?
Well, I would say that that's where the church has been a little bit remiss in the last decades. I think it's currently trying to address that inadequacy and become more of a community. But there is no doubt in my mind that after 1932, well, let me start, before 1932, you know, the church was everything. You know, the church governed all aspects of life, even economic farming questions and woolen mill questions and dress questions and how your hair had to be cut questions. I mean, the church really was everything. And I think in 1932, when those social economic things were cast into one direction and the religion in the other, I think the church is way, way, way overreacted and took a position way off to the side of people's lives, you know, saying we're going to be the spiritual force and that's it, and put the spiritual force way on one end of the spectrum and left this whole other area of people's lives that it did not want to, you know, be involved in. I think it lost meaning. You know, it almost was to the point where I think the church became meaningless in people's lives because it had put itself so far away from their lives. And, you know, the fact that it didn't even bother having German, you know, English services until so late in its history, and the fact that translating of these key documents didn't happen until just a few years ago when Janet started doing it. You know, I mean, the church was really saying, you know, was really taking a very non-activist role in the community, and I think, therefore, it really wasn't much of a factor in defining community. Really, I mean, that's how I feel. I think that's changing now. And that's what I think in the 60s, like I was saying, I think people were, you know, not rebelling against traditional religious values, but rebelling against the fact that the church was not really the bastion of religious values. You know, that it had taken a very distant approach and, you know, taking no positions on social issues. It was so afraid of offending anybody that it took, you know, even the sermons, you know, were probably very generically pious.
Do you think that that's done purposely? Is that based on the theology of the church?
I don't think it was done purposely. I think it was done by that generation who was so, like I said, who was reacting so strongly to the fact that the church had been such a central part and recognized the need that it couldn't be that central part anymore, and really just the pendulum swung over too far. That's how I kind of interpret it. I think if you ask those people, many of them are already dead now, actually, they would not have, they would disagree with me, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure they didn't see themselves as doing that. But that's how I look at it. I mean, the church became virtually a non-entity in the community. I mean, you know, it was still very important in the spiritual lives of people. You know, it was the central force. But you know, how do you separate that spiritual life from other people's lives? Or, you know, the rest of your lives? To me, and I think to a lot of other people, it had become no longer relevant.
I've been told that in the modern day, and this was just something that was given to me earlier, that this person was saying that she views Amana as a community within a community. There's the core community, which are the church members, the shareholders, the people with ancestry and German speakers, and then there is a peripheral community that's everything that that community isn't. Not church members, not German speakers, business owners living in Amana. What's your feeling about that? And if you agree with that, how does that go about being integrated?
I guess I don't agree with that all the way. I mean, I think there is kind of that. But I wouldn't call it a community within a community. Certainly there are groups within a community, you know what I mean? There are, you know, family groups, you know, just like in any community, there's family connections and business connections and this and that. I wouldn't say it's a community within another community. I wouldn't characterize it that way. I would say it's a community that has a lot of different components, and that this old communal descendant component is a very important and strong one, and maybe the defining one, you know. But I certainly don't see that as a separate community, really. I mean, nah, I can't agree with that all the way. But I do agree that integrating newcomers into Amana is a challenge. You know, because, but I think that's true in any small town. You know, people have their friends and they have their relationships and they do their thing, and then getting new people into a group, I don't care if it's a man or any place else, you know, is a challenge. And probably it's more of a challenge in a manner because there are no venues, no forums for public involvement. We don't have a city. So there's no city council meetings where people can come and yell at each other or agree with each other or have input or that kind of thing. You know, you can't debate issues. So that, like I say, it's probably tougher. I think it is tough for a newcomer to fully become part of the community. Tougher in a manner than maybe in some other place, because there is. And not because there's a community within a community, but because there's no really, you know, place to do it. Even now with the school, you know, you don't have just the Amana school where everybody could come together and identify with that school. It's consolidated, so that makes it more diffuse. You know, there's youth associations, the soccer team, the little league team. You know, you people get involved in those and they do what they can. And I just think that, you know, getting newcomers involved in the community is tough, and I think it's something we have to work on. But I don't see it as I think characterizing it as a community within a community is too strong as. Too strong a sense. When I think about the people I hang around with, for example, although probably more than half are Amana people, you know, who I grew up with, close to half are not Amana people. You know, people who've moved in and have lived here maybe already 20 or 40 years, you know, who I consider. They're part of my community, you know. I don't have a problem with that.
But would a lot of people still label those people outsiders?
I think some of the older generation would.
That word tossed around a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate to hear it. But, you know, that's a holdover from the communal times, too, you know, when there really was, you know, the community and then there's an outsider. But I think a lot of the older people kind of think that way. But I
they say it real quiet when they say it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. No, they probably don't even say it real quiet. You know, that's just the way they perceive life, really, you know. I really do. They look at, you know, I would say people who are over 60, maybe even over 50, probably do think in terms of community people and outsiders. You know, but I really think the younger people, I don't see it that way. Not the people I hang around with anymore.
Well, this question may be a little too personally topical, but what do you see as a man of refrigeration's role historically in maintaining community, or the opposite?
Well, I think certainly, say, from 1940s to 1960s, it played a very important role. I mean, it was the major employer of a man of people. And it was locally owned, locally managed. It was a major player in the community. Now that it's no longer locally owned or locally managed, it's virtually a non-entity in the community. It really is. I mean, it is surprising. One of my most favorite authors, Stephen Jay Gould, he writes a monthly column for Natural History Magazine. He's a paleontologist, writes about evolution and stuff a lot. I read all his stuff. He actually visited a man once. He was here in the museum, and I was here, and I didn't even know what my favorite guy. Anyway, he wrote an article then. He wrote an article in Natural History, and his biggest impression of a man, not biggest, but one of his biggest impressions, was that how this huge appliance manufacturing plant can be sitting here and nobody mentions it. It's not mentioned in the literature. You know, he had to kind of interpret it as a conspiracy to maintain this bucolic image of the area. But it's not that at all. I felt like writing him and telling him. It's just that a man of refrigeration is just not a player. It does not want to be involved. It does not, you know, it doesn't advertise itself in the tourist literature. It doesn't make a big deal about itself. It just really is not a factor in this community anymore. Except that it causes traffic problems and light, you know, light problems at night and some noise problems and things like that. But even there, they, you know, if they're approached, they'll do what they can to mitigate those. You know, it's not like, you know, they're not trying to anger the community. They do what they can to be a good citizen, but they essentially, you know, stay in their house and don't go and hang out at the bar at night. And become, you know, active socially. So they really, you know, they're really not worth talking about. That's the bottom line.
Let me ask this: being an historian, how, what steps do you take to emphasize to people that visit that a man is a living community instead of a dead commune? I guess is the easiest way to phrase that question.
Well, okay. First, I mean, we do it several ways, and some more formally than others. Certainly, we can't not deal with that issue because we have to train our guides and docents to deal with that issue because it is what is most surprising to me is how the high percentage of questions we get about a manna today. I mean, most people, it's hard to say, I don't have statistics, but my impression is many people who come here think it still is a commune. You know, so we're not explaining that it's still living. We're, you know, they're coming here thinking it's a living commune. They're not coming thinking it's a dead commune. So we have to tell them that it's still a community, but it's not a commune. So, you know, there's still people in Cedar Rapids, people in Iowa City still think this is a closed community. You have to be German, you have to be a descendant to live here. There's this notion that it's still a very tight, closed community, that it's still owned
collectively.
So where I mean, so and certainly in the church, when we interpret the Homestead Church building, you know, our major emphasis there is not to talk about the religious traditions as if they're something of the past, but as it's the amount of church today, and why is it the way it is today? Mm-hmm. You know, we consciously try to emphasize that it's. We're not talking about something that's dead here. We're talking about something that's still a very important part of the community. So, like I say, our challenge is not really so much to show that it's not a dead commune, but it's not that it's not a living commune.
Let's see. Well, I guess just I don't have many more questions, but I guess since this project is focused on this 65 to 75 period, I guess I'll just ask generally if there's anything from those years that was unique to that time period, anything that you remember that you think might be important to document. I know that's fairly broad, but
I don't know. I get the impression, knowing what you've talked about with other people before this, and I really think you've hit the key points. I don't really have anything that I can think of offhand to add there. Unless you can, that I've mentioned to you before that I forget about now.
I don't think so, unless you want to record the story about you refusing to cut your hair.
Sure. You know, let me tell you about that. You mentioned that. And then this morning, I got a telephone call from Don Jansen. He's the executive secretary of the Communal Studies Association. He lives in Kentucky. Over the weekend, he was at a meeting in Georgia. And he calls me up and he says, "Do you know you're famous?" And I go, "What do you mean by that?" He says, "I was at a meeting this weekend, and I heard this story about how you refused to cut your hair and didn't go on the senior trip." I said, "What are you talking about?" Anyway, he was at a meeting where also attending there was a former principal of Amana High School, who told him that story about me. So I just couldn't, and that's, you know, what coincidence, in 2 days, in 12 hours, that came back to haunt me twice. I had to laugh. But basically the story goes, and the owner, manager of a Amana Refrigeration at that time, a local person, always paid for an Amana High School seniors to go on a senior trip to Chicago, all expenses paid. You just got on the bus and went. That was the time where long hair was a little bit more in style, and I had fairly long hair. When I look at the pictures now, I have to laugh about how short it was. But, you know, really.
Shorter than this.
Oh, yeah. You could see the bottom of my ears. You know, it was, anyway, we got called into the office. There was about four of us boys, and said, "Unless you get your hair cut, Mr. Forstner," who was the guy, "says you're not going to be able to go on the senior trip." You know, there was the ultimatum. There was the challenge. And of course, you know, they had to know what we would say. You know, we essentially said, "Screw you, you know, we're not getting our hair cut." You know, so we did, you know, and what was really neat is that really the whole school rallied, and our class had, I can remember several, you know, class meetings where essentially our class then voted not to go on the senior trip. You know, the whole class kind of stuck behind it. And then, you know, ultimately it was very good. Because that after that, the classes had to work and raise money to go on their seat. You know, they had to earn it themselves. It was kind of, I think it was kind of bad. You know, in retrospect, I mean, you know, these kids should have not had that given to them, I don't think. So anyway, that's all that was.
So this was 1972 when you caused the cancellation?
1970. Yeah. And you know, that changed the tradition. You know, so we were iconoclasts there.
Oh gosh. Okay. I'll stop it there.